sometimes members of the Sangha share what's interesting to them. And so it's kind of like a peer study group, as opposed to me representing the Buddha's actual teachings. I just want to take a moment to let myself off the hook here. You know, because when you get interested in Buddhism, you know, it's like there's this back and forth thing of, it's like, it's so wonderful because the teachings really speak to you. But then you realize the, you know, distance. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, the more you appreciate, the more you realize how you're just beginning. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you get this appreciation, you know, it's like, wow, I got it. And then it's like, the dust of that settles down, and it's like, oh, you know, it's like seeing a picture of Mount Everest, and then it's like being excited because you understand Mount Everest, but it's different than being a Sherpa.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, with that disclaimer, you know, last couple talks, Dokai talked last time, and then before that, Tomen talked, and both of them started out apologizing a lot for their, you know, lack of understanding or whatever, and so I thought, gee, they're apologizing a lot, but then when you share, especially if you're not ordained as a teacher, it's like, so just to be clear, you know, this is a it's like Tonin said, really, in her email, you know, sharing our insights. So if this isn't about what Buddha said, this is about what's interesting to me, in a way. Mm-hmm. Okay. So last, I gave a talk before, and it was on suffering, and this is kind of a continuation of that talk. And last time, Chester Sheard, is that how you pronounce his name? Was sitting there. And he told me he appreciated some of the things I said and had some criticisms. I mean, well, you know, comments, you know, I mean, Chester didn't pull his punches. Mm-hmm. And he's not here anymore, and I wish he was. Yeah. Also, my son-in-law passed away 2 days ago. Yeah. And I wish he was here too. And I've learned a lot from both of these men. While I was meditating, one thing occurred to me is that, you know, it's like we talk a lot about impermanence, and these two men, you know, demonstrated that profoundly, so, among many, many other teachings. So, in the last talk, couple things I said, just to link to this, and I'm going to keep it simple today, I hope. But one of the things I said was that suffering was impermanent, because in Buddhism everything is impermanent, right? But suffering is impermanent, and I quoted something that Thich Nhat Hanh said, and he said, suffering is impermanent. That's why we can transform it. Happiness is impermanent. That's why we must nourish it. So that's one thing, is that, you know, it's like sometimes people, especially in psychotherapy, you know, some psychotherapy people think that there's like this suffering that's always there, and somehow you got to get it out and then you'll be okay. But according to Buddhism, as described by Virasatra Dhammo in his book, Suffering and No Suffering, he says, no, suffering is not a continuous state. And in fact, we're not a continuous state. The ego is not a continuous thing. It's something that we reconstruct moment by moment. He said something about that. Oh, yeah, he says the ego is not something that has to be eradicated. You know, in a lot of spiritual teachings, they talk about, you know, destroying the ego and all that. And Virasak Baradamal says in Buddhism, you know, the ego is not something that has to be eradicated. It just doesn't have to be, shouldn't be reborn constantly. You know, because it's just like everything else. It's impermanent. But he said, I like this quote. He said, Ada, self, or I, like ego, is not present in the human mind at all times. It arises in accordance with the law of dependent origination. Paticca Samuppada, that's probably not how you pronounce it, which states, if contact occurs, feeling arises. Upon feeling, desire arises. Upon desire, attachment arises. Upon attachment, being or existence arises. Upon being or existence, birth arises. Thus, a new mind and a new body have arisen completely. This is the birth in concept of I. When the birth is body and mind, it is called life or atta or ego. So we can see desire and attachment and feeling cause atta to arise momentarily. We can prevent or keep the mind free from atta by detaching from the feeling that arises at the moment of contact. When atta does not arise, suffering and all the problems associated with human life do not arise. Not so easy for me. But then he quotes Buddha and he says, the basis for this is that the original mind is luminous. It is tarnished by the presence of visiting defilements. The original mind is luminous. It is untarnished due to the absence of visiting defilements. And he recommends that people contemplate that paragraph a lot. He says that it would be helpful to kind of get the idea that, you know, the mind is, it's already whole and complete and not in need. The original mind is not in need of improvement. And cannot be impaired. It can be tarnished, but another analogy that they use in the East is that it's like the sun, you know, that it can be overcast. That doesn't have an effect on the sun, but it has an effect on our experience of the sun. So I thought I would just break that down a little bit. Because what he's talking about is dependent origination. And Dokai was touching on that last time when he said that moment by moment we have feelings that... He says there's only three kinds of feelings in Buddhism. There's positive feeling or pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant, which is also a feeling. Dokai was talking about the beginning of this chain of dependent origination. One of the things that I like about Buddha is that he deconstructs experience so that we can understand what's happening. Because things happen just so fast, this dependent chain of dependent origination, brrr, like that, and suddenly we're in a state. How did I get there? And so Buddha deconstructs it. He slows this chain of suffering or experience or creation down. And it's like a slow motion film, and he stops action on it so we can see what's happening. This is the short form of dependent origination. Actually, I have some of these
I can pass it down.
Okay, good. Are there two or three there?
So two.
Okay. Yes. No. Another one. So, if you look at the side that says contact with ignorance, so ignorance is kind of sets the whole chain of suffering in motion after contact, and just to also link to the last talk I said I gave, where I referred to Virasak Viradamo, and he said that ignorance is the failure to fully realize eight things. And the eight in Buddhism, the eight things are suffering, the cause of suffering, no suffering, which does not mean the eradication of suffering. It means no suffering. According to Virasak Viradamo. And the path leading to no suffering, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. The past, failure to fully realize the past, failure to fully realize the future, between the past and the future, and dependent origination, failure to fully realize dependent origination. So, I mean, I don't know anybody that has fully realized any of these things, you know? And so he says that the dependent origination is the deepest of Buddha's teachings. So it's not something that you can get like a regular academic subject, because getting anything intellectually is relatively shallow understanding. It's just the intellect. And so to fully realize the teaching of dependent origination, it's only realized in your life, moment by moment. It's, you know, so on the other hand, I think it's helpful to get an intellectual grasp of something. And so I thought I would just talk about some of the terms that he uses in dependent origination. And so contact. When we contact something, it stimulates the nervous system, and that's where the feeling comes from, of positive, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's a stimulation of the nervous system. And then from that leads to desire, which is, it feels good, want more of that. Feels bad, don't want that. Grasping and aversion. Or confusion. Is it good or bad? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I identify with that reaction in my nervous system. I say, that's me. I am feeling good. I am feeling bad. That's attachment. Identification is attachment. Mm-hmm. Attachment leads to the being that goes along with that. And the being gives birth to one of the beings in the six realms in Buddhism. So there's hell, hungry ghosts. You familiar with some of this, Nick?
No.
Oh, okay. So the six styles of suffering, basically. Hell, I'm angry, that's hell. Longing for something that I don't have, that's hungry ghost. Fighting spirits, well, that can be anger too, but who has a better definition of fighting spirits? Do you, Peter? Asuras?
Tony was saying that the Tibetans, and they make a really beautiful wheel of life that you could probably find on the internet. It shows it all pictorially. But she was saying that the fighting spirits, they have a lemon tree that's growing in their realm, their portion of the picture. And the one next to it, which is maybe Hungry Ghost. So the fighting spirits have a lemon tree, and it's leaning over into the next one, and they're getting all the lemons.
Yes. But they're doing all the work, right?
They're doing all the... It's their tree, but they can't get any lemons, so it's like unjust, you know?
So they have
a fighting spirit because of maybe this injustice.
Right.
Yeah. Or the inability to get what they want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
We can all identify with that in life, right?
Totally.
That's right. If you've ever held a job.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or have a family doing all the work and somebody else.
So how many is that? Let's see. Hell, Hungry Ghost,
Animal,
Fighting Spirits. Animal. So what would be animal? Just attached to sensation. Satiation.
Instincts. Moving
instincts.
By instincts.
Yeah, yeah.
Only without
basic
thinking. Yeah. Human realm. And then the realm of the demigods. And they're all impermanent. So even, you know, it's like you're in the realm of the demigods, it's not going to last. And so there's like this background anxiety there. It's also isolated from other beings because there is not compassion there. They're good to go in their own, you know, they don't care about other people. And then the human realm, as far as I understand it, you know, sometimes people say, well, that's where we want to be. But that's not so great either. Because in the human realm, there's me. Hey, I'm a human. So there's the identification with the self in the human realm, which is subject to anxiety and threat and protect, all that.
But I understand that's the ideal realm to be in, the human realm.
For transformation.
For transformation.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Yeah, because in the human realm, you can relate to your states better. Hell is, they say, I don't want this. Personally, I'm not advocating for this. They say hell is a better place to be for liberation than heaven. Because if you're in heaven, you don't want to be liberated. You don't want freedom or truth. But if you're in hell, you really want to get out of there. So there's more motivation. Mm-hmm. But all of them are, you know, the states come and go. And so death happens. And so when they say all of this equals suffering, it's not that, suffering comes after that. Suffering comes at any point in there. Dale Verkulin, in his book, I forget the title. Mary, do you remember?
Fire, something about this.
Tending the fire.
He talks about dependent origination, and he said you can. There are some places that are easiest to get off the wheel. And I think Shohaku Okamura said that too, about the same, you know, like at the beginning is the easiest place to get, when you're aware of feeling, not getting on the whole thing, that's the easiest place to get off. But Dale says, he's a Zen priest, and he and his wife have spoken here many times. He says you can actually get off at any point. And that's part of Buddha breaking it down like that, so you can better identify what's going on, you know. Part of identifying what's going on helps you step out of the story of your experience, which is so compelling, you know, seductive. Mm-hmm. It's in fairy tales, they talk about it as spells.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So just going down here, the contact. Contact is the convergence in Buddhism of a sense organ, such as your ear, sense consciousness, which is what activates the ear, and the sense object. So, you know, it's like I have contact with this sound because it's happening, and my ear, and plus sense consciousness. But you need all three for there to be contact. So So this is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but if I kept doing it, it would become unpleasant. If I was sleeping, there'd be no contact, because even though the sound is there and the sense organ is there, the sense consciousness isn't there. Mm-hmm. So three come together. And in Buddhism, there are six sense organs. I love this part, because, you know, the regular five sense organs, but in Buddhism, the brain is also a sense organ. And what is the sense object that the brain senses? It's thoughts. Mm-hmm. Thoughts are an object. And they call it mental formations. A thought can either be, in contact with a thought will either be pleasant or unpleasant, or you're confused. Is it or neither pleasant nor unpleasant? When we have contact with anything, there's feeling in the nervous system. It's a nervous system response to activation of any of the sense organs with that sense consciousness. So Virasakaradamo says, you know, and then after feeling, don't want it, and that's desire, the wanting. And he says desire is a demand made on the universe. He says demand with ignorance is desire, demand with wisdom is aspiration. If you get a chance, check out that book or borrow it from me. Suffering and No Suffering. It's just one of these amazing books. Mm. He's the resident priest at the Hinsdale Wat Dharma, Buddha Dharma Wat, you know, the...
I was there for a retreat one time, yeah.
I was there to see a Hindu person once. It's in Hinsdale, Illinois. So, and then just going on with the definitions in Buddhism, there's three kinds of desire. So there's desire for sensory pleasure, and then the you know, and that could be spiritual bliss or pizza. You know, it's all in the same thing. And interestingly, in mystical Judaism, it has the same thing. Pleasure in Hebrew is called gan, and whether you're, you know, the highest pleasure relatively, or pizza or anything, it's all gan. But then the highest pleasure in Judaism, mystical Judaism, the highest pleasure that a human being can experience is the pleasure of the knowledge of God. It probably in Buddha. In Buddhism, and again, I'm not a Buddhist teacher, but for me, you know, Buddha nature fits in nicely with my understanding of God. For me, there's no contradiction, because my God is not someone with a clipboard up there, you know, wholly focused on me. That's my job. And I'm trying to get off that job. Trying to get a different job description. But, you know, for any thinking person, you can't, I mean, the idea of the injustice between, you know, what people are dealing with on the planet, you know. I understand there's a really funny show on Broadway called Act of God. With Jim Parsons, have you heard of it?
No.
And he talks about, he plays God. He says that, you know, God has a wrath management problem. It's just the God of the Old Testament. And he talks about, you know, like people, especially athletic teams, believing that God is on their side. And he says I don't take any favorites when it comes to professional sports, and that might be really hard for the Yankee fans to understand. anyway, enough of that. So But I find it so useful, this understanding the three kinds of desire, because it's like I'll get stuck in a painful place and then I'll realize, wow, I'm craving a different existence. Mm. You know, or non-existence. Existence like whatever it might be, you know. It's like not having a headache. Or having a big house. I was just, you know, driving here down Lake Drive, and I said to Mary, I love these houses on Lake Drive. And then I said, maybe love isn't the right word. Maybe covet would be another word. But it's kind of like, oh, it's just, oh, there's that, you know, desire for existence or non-existence. Because you get up, caught up in the story of it. And then you realize, wow, I'm doing that thing again. I'm doing that craving. And then it's like, okay, easier to let go of the story. Mm-hmm. Attachment is clinging to desire. And then the being, the six realms here, and so forth. And birth, in Buddhism, when they talk about birth, they mean those six realms. And there's four kinds of birth in Buddhism. There's births, moisture-born beings, egg-born beings, womb-born beings, and spontaneously born beings. So that's what they mean, the six realms, and where those six realms are getting born over and over again. Well, now, if you flip to the other side, Virasagaragama says, okay, that's contact with ignorance, where you're ignorance, the nervous system gets stimulated, the feeling's there, and hey, that's me. That's ignorance. And then blah, 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 blah after that. But if there's contact with wisdom, because there's going to be contact in wisdom, and he says mindfulness is the speed of wisdom. Love that definition. Mm-hmm. He says feeling is understood to be impermanent, empty of self, and unsatisfactory. Even if it's great, the feeling, it's like it's a mirage in a way, because it doesn't exist after a moment. It's a mirage. But it's like, wow, this is reality. This is me. And this is, hey, I'm here. I'm, you know. And then it's like this these stories and these realms get born. You know, it's like a really fecund, in a way, creative, this kind of creativity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like divine in some way, in a painful way. But, you know, we are, like, responsible for creating these worlds.
Yeah.
Constantly. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of, you know, what the great teachers say is, hey, relax, it's already created. You don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. All right. So he says detachment from feeling and desire. There's feeling, and it's like, okay. And I can tell you that helps me. You know, I get that a lot. He says that's renunciation in the moment. You know, you don't have to go to a monastery. It's like in Tibet, or no, Thailand, they have a phrase, throwing it back. So they say, you know, it's like, oh, you know, someone looked at me funny, you know. And then, okay, wait, am I going to go there? And the answer is, yes, I usually am going to go there. But it's like, okay, I can throw it back. You know, this is I'm learning. You know, I'm hopefully learning. So, he says, no attachment to feeling and desire. And desire is not clung to. No identification with the feeling leads to no self. He says, that's where no self in Buddhism, where no self comes from, is it's not created. It's not, hey, a self that is dealing with all the stuff, it's no. And therefore, no suffering. And he said that's all that Buddha taught, was suffering and no suffering. And Buddha, he says, Buddha said throughout his career that that's what he's teaching, suffering and no suffering. There's a lot of Buddhist teachings, most of which are written by people after Buddha died, which are kind of commentaries on it. So he says, the goal is the middle way of mind beyond positive and negative conditions. So positive is not better than negative because it leads to attachment. And then he says, what does he say? That going after the positive states, the mind becomes agitated and weary, unable to experience real peace. So, going after the positive does not lead to peace. So he says that, and he has just, you know, says very clear and original takes on some of these, you know, common Buddhist notions. But the middle way, he says, the middle way is moment by moment. That's the middle way. The middle, not going after positive grasping, not running away from the negative aversion, not being in confusion, throwing it back, being in the middle. He says that is, they call it Nirodha, which is emptiness, or Nirvana, which is not agitated, or peace. He goes into a lot about Nirvana. He says that Nirvana is a common Sanskrit word, and it has like five different meanings. So, you know, if the lake is calm, they might say Nirvana. And or if someone's, you know, something's cool, it's Nirvana. So he has all these different meanings. And over here we just, oh, Nirvana. But he says Nirvana refers to the natural human state that is not agitated, you know, by various conditions. Anyway, so thanks for listening. I wanted to share that. So, yeah, what are your comments?
You know, I'm just kind of smiling to myself because, you know, the invitation we often have from others when we're chatting or just meeting is, hi, how are you, you know? And wouldn't it be interesting if we were able to say, I'm neutral, thank you. I mean, this whole idea of not being anything. We always have this constant invitation by others to kind of verbalize what we are at the moment, and I think it invites the recognition of some kind of feeling, or else we lie about it. I don't know, but it's kind of interesting, isn't it? You know?
It is. Yeah. Yeah, I used to work at this clinic, and the clinic director, and she was great. I loved her, but she was always like, you're really a high energy person, and she would say, I'd say, hey, how are you? I'm fantastic. How are you? And I'd say, okay, just okay. And I'm like, what's wrong with okay? I'm okay. I was okay, now I'm not okay. Right. You know, I'm hoping you're feeling better. Have a great day. You know, so. And she was a really kind, beautiful person. Mm-hmm. And she is a psychotherapist. And so am I. And I can understand, you know, and she saw a lot of people. And a lot of children. And I can understand the value in trying to keep up like that. Yeah. For me, it's more valuable to keep neutral. Mm-hmm. Also, seeing other people in psychotherapy, if I'm up, there's no room for them to be real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. I took a lot to the descriptions of suffering and explaining how it arises in the mind in here. The way that I understood suffering was that you allow your experiences to cause suffering. Because, you know, I have a lot of pain in my back. I messed it up, and I'm probably just going to always have that. So I could choose to come here today and, you know, complain about it and say, oh, I wish that I didn't have this. I wish, you know, doctors could do more. I wish all these other things. Or I could just accept it and say, but those aren't happening. This is how I get to experience this day.
Yeah.
So you choose to allow something to cause suffering, and you choose to say, I'm not going to allow that to cause suffering. I'm just going, it's there, okay, but that doesn't have to be everything that I focus on. It doesn't have to be, I don't have to give that power over this situation, because then I could come in here and I could say, oh, you know, I could talk for everybody's ear off about all this stuff that nobody wants to hear. By giving it power and by saying, well, all I am right now is my suffering. I see a lot of people do that. Every problem that they have, they just pour everything into it that becomes who they are to the rest of the world. And it's just not fulfilling. You can see that it drains them to do that.
Yes.
It really drains people to pour everything into what they feel is causing their suffering. A lot of this explains, you know, it's great ways to say, you know, realize that, identify with it, and then push it away. You don't have to be stuck dwelling on that. You can, as you said, you can jump off of that wheel at any point in time. I know it's correlating, but but yeah, it's good to remind yourself of that every once in a while, that, you know, you are giving this power, you know, right? You don't have to.
There is a very popular form of psychotherapy that's getting a lot of good reviews. It's called acceptance and commitment therapy, and it's one of the therapies that use mindfulness, developed by Stephen Hayes at the University of Nevada. But it's just like taken off, because mindfulness is like the buzzword. And, you know, he does a lot with that. But one of the neat things about acceptance and commitment therapy is accepting what's out of your control. So, for example, with anxiety, he says, you don't have control over anxiety. So a lot of therapies try to get rid of anxiety, whereas acceptance and commitment therapy is, oh, you accept the anxiety. And it's in the business, it's called a paradoxical intervention, because it actually reduces your anxiety, because you don't have anxiety about the anxiety. So when you have people with anxiety, there's always, and I've had anxiety all my life, you know, but there is anxiety about the anxiety. Am I going to get anxiety? Is it going to screw me up? Is it going to get worse? You know, yada, yada, yada. And so, okay, you know, you just accept there's going to be anxiety, and then you focus on commitment to your values in line with the life you want, just as you said.
I think one of the readings I read a bit by Yoko Beck from California, and one of the things that she said is that you have to take a step back and you have to be the watcher. And you have to watch what's coming in at you. You have to watch your responses to it. You have to realize that a lot of those things are not your core. They're not I. They're you observing this, making a choice because of it. If you take a step back and you just kind of observe what's going on, you can change everything about the situation and everything about how you perceive it, everything from that point on. Just so long as you can work your way back up and say, okay, what am I really observing? What is the cause of this? And I'm just going to, again, choose not to go that way. But it takes understanding that you have to observe your own thoughts. Because if you don't observe your own thoughts, then your thoughts are literally what you are, and that you're not going back far enough. So it was a really cool sort of explanation of, oh, well, you know, these are how a lot of people manage things that are beyond what other people can manage.
Mm-hmm.
This is how they do that. This is how they, you know, refocus and, you know, deal with things like anger and sadness and desire by just taking a step back and being able to watch it incoming. And yeah, like you said, that's really hard to do. You can even see it coming sometimes, depending on what it is, and just completely lose control over the situation. But yeah, it's you know, again, I wouldn't have known that had I not been told that.
Yeah.
Or at least seen that and then practiced it and then gone, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
It's as Chuck said, it's like stepping out of the story, right? Stepping mm-hmm. out of the story for a moment. And, you know, this notion of self-observation, it's not easy to do at times because we get so caught up in our story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need a little whack on the head or a little reminder, maybe a little bell in your pocket or a buzzer that goes off and says, you know,
yeah.
Look at your story for a moment.
Look
at your story.
Thich Nhat Hanh, you would have, like, called it the mindfulness bell. Mm-hmm. It's like every once in a while they bing, and then you just stop and step out of your story.
Yeah, I think I heard someone from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition saying that they would, you know, check in kind of where they are consciously. Either they worked in an office every time the phone rang or every time they walked through a doorway.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things like that where you can just stop and say and see where you are. And sometimes you will be going on about a story. I know, you know, it could be like I had something bad happened in college. It was, nothing. It wasn't that serious, but it was a kind of a bad situation. And I've thought about it a million times since then. But, you know, if something happens, that, you know, if a phone rings, you can check in and you can just let it go because it's okay. Not coming back.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would still get angry every time I thought about it.
Yeah.
So it can be helpful to have some way of checking in like that. If you got a ding on your watch or whatever. I don't do that type of thing much, but
yeah,
sure,
it's not a bad idea.
I think with our practice, whatever it is, so we it's like we develop. I don't know what, maybe thermostat's not the right word, but you know, when Chuck was talking about anxiety, I have a level of anxiety too. That when it gets to a certain level, there's a sensation or a feeling, so it's kind of like my alarm that says, look at this,
right,
and, you know, see if you can just, and just, as you said, just by stepping outside for a moment, looking at it, and letting it go rather than, you know, or knowing that it's there, not getting all upset about it, just a state of what I am at the moment, somehow sort of diminishes it, and recognizes
it. I had that today meditating, part of me doesn't want to be here because there's just a lot of grief and at what's going on. And so at the beginning it was like, oh, I really don't want to be here. But I have found through experience, I had to be there with what was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And even that is the Buddha.
Yeah.
So it's like not pushing it away because it gets worse and worse, but okay, this is what's going on, I stay with it, and then pretty soon, not feeding it, but being with it, and then pretty soon, you know, I follow my breath, and then there's that peaceful state that comes in, but it comes back. But I think my experience is pushing it away does not work. It's you're with it, and you have to be in the midst of it, and have to you are living in the midst of that chaos in the moment, and that's reality too. Or your pain, you can't really deny it's there.
Sure.
So, but you can have ways, or some people do writing, because you can't just say, I tried this, where not just today, but you just, okay, I feel such and such or such and such as a trigger. And sometimes it begs to be looked at separately, you know. And so you have to do that too. Because we do live in a corporal body. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is suffering, the corporal body.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's having a relationship with, I think, for me, it's having a relationship with that aspect of wisdom and using mindfulness to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That works.
Chuck, I think in your last talk you mentioned that somebody who kind of became or enlightened or awakened himself by saying, "This too is not me," every time. I don't know if you said, maybe I'm misremembering that, but these bad situations are fanning you back to say that this is not me, because truly, you know, it really fundamentally isn't. It might be part of your reality in that moment, but it's not you. Mm-hmm. It's not certainly not the whole of you.
Mm-hmm.
I think your points correlate a lot to something that you said, where a lot of psychotherapy programs are based on, well, you know, we have to mitigate the anxiety, we have to mitigate the depression. A lot of people will either hyper-focus on their ailment or whatever is going on in their life, you know, loss, things like that. Or they'll say, okay, well, I need to get rid of that, and
right.
I need to resolve this, and then it's going to go away. And what I find interesting about that is there's nothing anywhere that said that that was bad, that, you know, feeling this pain is bad,
exactly.
Feeling loss is bad. Those are things that we're going to feel. I mean, Buddha himself even said, life is suffering.
Right.
So we have to kind of expect, like, okay, I am going to feel these things, and I have to be okay with that, versus, well, I don't want to feel those things.
Right.
And that's attachment to the desire of feeling okay. And one of the things I have to do while I'm meditating is, you know, sitting here with this perfect posture, my back starts to hurt after a while, and I have to remind myself, that's okay. I don't have to move. I don't have to pay attention to it, because I'm not here right now. This doesn't exist because of where I'm putting my mind when I'm meditating. These things don't matter. You know, again, I see a lot of people going, and, you know, a lot of people in my life focusing on either I need to get rid of this, or this is all that I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very interesting watching people, you know, go down those paths and then what that leads to.
And I think it's what the Sangha is for, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at times you can feel a buoyancy from the people you've been practicing with.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to even be with you, but you know that there are other people practicing and going through very consciously that same experience. So that's like a buoyancy for a support for that. But that's why I think one of the things about, I mean, the newest things in psychotherapy are to extract certain things like mindfulness or whatever. But I always tell Chuck too, I think it has to be in the context of a sangha. Mm-hmm. You know, it's learning these things is great. But then people can still feel isolated.
Oh, for sure.
And I think the total practice is really, really important. You know, people's sitting, and not just in their own closets and sitting. You know, I think sitting with a group and being real like we are today is very, very important in you know, learning various techniques and things.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
You know, in psychotherapy, it's like you look at the external situation and the internal situation. And so you kind of want to help people internally, but in harmony with the external situation. You know,
right.
So if someone's in an abusive external situation, that has to be addressed. You know, if community is lacking in the external situation, you know, you can do psychotherapy all the time, and it's not going to replace
right.
something essential that's missing. So I've told several guys, especially, I've said, you don't need therapy, you need community.
Yeah.
And then I helped them get into various men's groups or, you know, other kind of program. And they call me back and they say, yeah, I don't think I need any more therapy. And it's like, great, that was a good referral. But until that point, I'm part of their sangha. It's like when people come to see me, okay, we've got a sangha of two, you know, and I'm part of their community. But it's important to help people not get stuck there. That, you know, they have to have a way of, you know, I want to help them to experiment with their life in making choices that, you know, what works, what doesn't.
I was raised a Christian, and in the Bible they say wherever, you know, two or three of you meet together, I am there with you.
That's, I learned that too.
There I am.
That's a nice thought.
There's a word in Hindi too called satsang, which you've heard, meaning in the company of truth, and I've always really felt that that kind of explains it nicely.
I can't remember where I read it, but I know that I've seen someone write the words that you can't have understanding without meditation, without having a sangha, and without having the truth, or at least paths towards the truth. So, the Dharma.
The Dharma, the Sangha, and what is it?
The three deities.
The Buddha. Buddha. Take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
That's what you're saying.
Well, that seems like a good note to chant out on.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chester.
Thank you very much. Yeah.